just to get a quick review of what I said last night, that about the way I define New Age movement, what I'd like to do this morning is give some historical background on it, not only because I want the history, but the history is illuminative for some of what people still believe inside the New Age movement. Remember last night I said that the New Age is defined as, first of all, a movement rather than an organization, but a very significant movement that involves billions of dollars annually in this country. Secondly, it's characterized by a belief that everything is one being. Everything is one. Thirdly, that everything is God. And fourthly, they're looking forward to a new age, a new millennium. Well, again, any fool knows that a new millennium is coming. So, year 2000 and what? One, right? The year 2000 is not the beginning of the new millennium, is it? That's the last year of the old millennium. And the year 2001, January 1st, that starts the new millennium, right? So sometimes they don't even get that right. Well, you gotta learn that there's no year zero, so they gotta learn the math. But that's pretty left brain and they don't like that either. So given that as the background, what I'd like to do is take a look at the history of the New Age movement. Where does it come from? And it is definitely homegrown American. This is, its roots are right here in America. We didn't need the Europeans to help us with this. We did it ourselves. Where does it get its roots? In some ways, two movements inside this country that prepared the way for the New Age go way back in our, maybe three movements in our culture. One is Unitarianism and Universalism. You know, those two are churches. One church, the Universalist Church, teaches that everybody and all dogs go to heaven. It's universal salvation. And Unitarianism believes that there's not a Trinity, but there's only one God, and you can't really come up with a good idea about God, or the one idea, so any idea about God is good. And this would be some of the basis for a lot of people believing that there are many different paths to God, and it's like spokes on a wheel. They all, the spokes, go to the same center. Well, a lot of Unitarians would also believe that all religions lead back to the one God. And you can call them any name you want because no name is acceptable or definitive. So, and so there's no Trinity. So, you know, whatever you want is fine. As a matter of fact, on National Public Radio on Thursday, they had a very nice piece, a very informative piece, in their news program, describing how witchcraft and paganism has now become part of Unitarian Universalist Church, and that they're doing pagan worship inside the Unitarian Universalist churches because they have no principle on which to exclude them. That's just another spoke. It's another way to God, isn't it? And, or the goddess, in that case. And this is important because a lot of influential Americans in the early 19th century, like Thoreau and others, Emerson, belonged to this movement. And they set a certain tone for the intellectual community. So it's important to be aware of how this has had influence. Preparing the way, you see, we have to keep in mind that certain intellectual climates will give more permission and more of a sense of acceptance of ideas. And Unitarianism and Universalism did that. Another movement in this country that has perhaps prepared the way for the New Age, or distinct from the New Age, is the Masonic Lodge. Remember how many of the founders of this country were Masons. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, that whole crowd was Masonic. And the Masonic Lodge started in the early 1700s, I think 1714, 1715, something like that. And Protestant churches have had a tremendous difficulty condemning the Masonic Lodge. I don't know if you realize, just last year, the Southern Baptist Convention could not come up with a decision that this was wrong for Baptists to belong. And there are thousands of Protestant ministers in the Masonic Lodge. Thousands. That's more the, matter of fact, the Masonic Lodge is much more of a Protestant problem than it is Catholic. We have more New Agers, perhaps, than, say, the Baptists or the other evangelicals. They have more Masons. You know, so, I mean, pick your poison. I don't like either one. But we've been able to at least say that the Masonic Lodge is something a Catholic may not belong to, and that the New Age is something that is contradictory to our faith as well. They can't come up with that statement. They voted it down when it was brought up at the last Southern Baptist Convention. And if you get a little bit of grief from some of the brothers and sisters at the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, bring that up. Why has it taken you almost 300 years and you still can't condemn Masonic Lodge? Because we had no problem doing that right away. We still have none. But this is important because the Masonic Lodge teaches that all the different religious scriptures teach basic truths. And you can search any of the scriptures of Hinduism and Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism and Islam and find the basic truths found in all of them. Again, this sets up a certain intellectual climate that makes Christianity relativized. You know, you have your belief and I have mine and it's okay. And that, you know, look behind for the real meaning in scripture as interpreted by the Masonic Lodge. That has a major influence, and we can't, you know, dismiss the influence of the Masonic Lodge in this country. For instance, one of its most successful religious offshoots is the Mormon Church. Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and that whole crowd belonged to the Masonic Lodge from 1840 to 44. And they derived most of the Mormon ceremonies from the Masonic Lodge. Matter of fact, Joseph Smith died flashing the Masonic symbol for distress, hoping that some of his would-be murderers would try and help him. If they were Masons, they had to. So that's another influence of the Masonic Lodge. I don't agree with those who say that the New Age movement is part of the Masonic Lodge. I don't think that's right. The New Agers aren't well organized. The Masons are. It's a very highly structured, secretive society, whereas the New Age doesn't show those signs. But attitudes from the Masonic Lodge certainly would prepare the way for accepting New Age ideas. That would be my point. And then a third influence in the early 1800s, would be from mesmerism. Ever hear of Dr. Anton Mesmer? He invented hypnosis as a form of therapy. Now, people have been hypnotized long before that. They didn't know what to call it. And they talk about trances and ecstasies and all sorts of other terms. But he gave it a certain term, and it became known as mesmerism. And mesmerism, or hypnosis, became very popular in the early 1800s. And it was a fad at that time. And that fad of hypnosis has had a major influence on the New Agers and on some of their techniques. Now, those would be some of the preparatory movements: Unitarianism, Universalism, the Mesmerism, and the Masonic Lodge. But what was the direct experience that led to the founding or the establishment of something we now call the New Age movement? Started in 1848 when two young girls in upstate New York, Catherine and Margaret Fox, started to hear table rapping. The furniture would make those kind of rapping noises, but nobody was touching the table. Ooh, scary kids, I'm telling you. And these girls were themselves frightened. Their mom was frightened. They thought the house was haunted by a peddler who had been murdered in the house and buried there, they said. And they worked out a system of communicating with this spirit that they would start to read the earth. They would start to recite the alphabet. And as they recited the alphabet, when they heard a click, that was the letter where they should stop. So, A, B, C. A. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. That's how they spell a cat. Alright? Now that's fairly cumbersome as a technique, but that's what they used. And people tried to do all sorts of things to prove it wasn't they, and assume that it wasn't a spirit, that it was these girls somehow doing this, making the noise, but it was never able to be proven. And within a year, by 1849, P.T. Barnum proved his point that a sucker is born every minute. And he hired these girls to come to his circus in New York. And he would charge people $1 a session to come listen to the spirits and get information from the spirits. And, you know, $1 in 1849 was really $1. You know, so they were doing all right. And they continued this. Even though by the mid-1850s, they became alcoholics and started having all sorts of other problems. Well, this experience of spiritism began a spiritist revival or a spiritist movement, not revival because it just got started. By 1859, right before before the Civil War, almost 10% of the U.S. population believed in spiritism and practiced it in some form. That's just 10 years. This swept the U.S. population. And spiritist churches got started. One of them was even a spiritist free love church. This is in the 1850s that people would get naked and have orgies together in the spiritist free love church. You know, it caused something of a scandal, to be sure, but it was able to exist in New York. And all sorts of spiritists started and denominations and all, it just spread like wildfire. So that, like I say, 10% of the U.S. population would say that they were spiritists by 1859. Now, the Civil War became a major distraction, to say the least. And spiritism went into a hiatus for that period. As a matter of fact, one of the Fox sisters became so upset with the way her life had gone, she became a Catholic and renounced her spiritism. Priests wouldn't let her into the church until she renounced it because the church has consistently and still consistently condemns any form of spiritism. No Catholic may legitimately be contacting the spirits of the dead and holding seances. That's a mortal sin against the first commandment. You learn that in the Baltimore Catechism, right? And we also learn it from Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9 through 11. Let there not be found among you anyone who burns his son or daughter, or anybody who consults a familiar spirit, or an enchanter, or a sorcerer, or anybody else who manipulates various forms of magic. We may not do that. That's strictly forbidden. So this Fox sister, I think it was Margaret, had to give it up, and she became a Catholic. Unfortunately for her, she later renounced her Catholicism and went back to the Spiritism because she needed to support her drinking habits. And by the way, it's interesting how the Spiritists themselves point out that a disproportionately large number of Spiritists become alcoholics. This is not unusual at all. Well, after the Civil War, Spiritism shot right back up in popularity, largely because people wanted to connect with their dead brothers, fathers, husbands, who were killed in the war. Now, we lost more Americans in the Civil War than in any other war we fought. So there's a terrible devastation in absolute numbers, also in terms of the percentage of the population. And people wanted to talk to their loved ones who died so prematurely in a very horrible war. So have you been to the Memorial Hall over at Harvard University? You know, where they honor all the Union generals and officers that were killed. As most of my friends in Tennessee and Texas say, that's one of the finest memorials to Southern marksmanship we have seen yet. But that's not very nice, now, is it? But the spiritism continued to grow until in 1875, before we get to some of its problems, let's also talk about one of its big successes. In 1875, a Russian noblewoman had heard about this great spiritist revival taking place in America. This woman was Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. This name is a name to remember. She is one of the most important people for understanding the development of the New Age movement. Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. She was a baroness from Russia, very headstrong young girl, who ran away from home at 18 or so, 16 or 17, pretty young child, to go and get married to a 65-year-old general. Now, that December, April, that's not even May, she was an April bride, he was definitely December, did not last very long, and she ran away from him. And Madame Blavatsky traveled all over the Orient, in Tibet, India, Persia, all over the Egypt, going to these places in search of the mystical. When she heard about this spiritist movement, she came to America to investigate it and came to New York. And she met with the Fox sisters. When she found out that the Fox sisters were speaking to a spirit of a peddler, a mere peasant, while she was a baroness, she just disregarded them and went and did her own thing. But what was important is that she made some disciples here in the United States, a couple lawyers, and they started in 1875 the Theosophical Society. And the Theosophical Society, started by Madame Blavatsky and her disciples, became a very important part of what we now call the New Age movement, as we'll see in a minute. Now, the next year, 1876, they had sort of a bad turn for spiritism because both of the Fox sisters went to the New York Times newspaper and they confessed in public and demonstrated at a public exhibition in a theater that they had been faking it all along. They were able to crack their toe knuckles and their knee joint and project the sound into furniture. And they've been doing that all along. Very talented young ladies. They made a living off of cracking their toe knuckles. And, it's only in America, right? And so they made a public confession of this. It was a major shock. A major shock. But they went ahead and did it. And then, even after that, they recanted their recantation. Meanwhile, spiritist churches continued to flourish and grow. And Madame Blavatsky's Theosophical Society began to grow. And Madame Blavatsky, again, did not want to contact some peasant, a peddler, to leave. She contacted the Ascended Masters of the Great White Brotherhood. These are the higher spirits. These are the great spirits. Especially Saint Germain. Now, Saint Germain is not some Catholic saint. That's the last, Saint Germain is the last name of a French baron from the time of the French Revolution, who was a libertine and an occultist. And it's his spirit that she was contacting, not some Catholic saint. So don't ever think of Saint Germain as some saint. If you study anything about the New Age movement, you'll hear a lot about Saint Germain. And it's the last name of a French nobleman who was a very big occultist. And they consider Saint Germain one of the highest of the ascended masters, if not the most highly ascended of the white masters, of the white brotherhood. Jesus is typically portrayed as being a lesser master than Saint Germain. And the Lady Mary or Mother Mary, they don't want to call her Our Lady, but Mother Mary is often another ascended master. Why she's not a mistress, I just don't understand, but that's maybe just too sexist. I don't know, they're not politically correct. But the Mother Mary is another ascended master, and there are lots and lots of other ascended masters, Kumi and a bunch of others. And Madame Blavatsky was in contact with these and used to get messages from the ascended masters. She would put a letter to them in a cabinet, lock it. People would guard it to make sure. And sure enough, you'd come back and the answer was in that locked cabinet and nobody had opened up that door. It was absolutely astounding. And people came from all over to be astounded by this experience. What later on was shown to be the case is that there was a false wall in the back. They went to Madame Blavatsky's bedroom and they would rotate the false wall and put the answers in. And two British investigators caught her at this. But until she was caught with this fraud, many people really loved Madame Blavatsky and were amazed at the ascended masters actually writing down this information. Madame Blavatsky and her Theosophical Society remains a fairly small group for a couple reasons. One, they are very, very jealous of power within the group. And even while she was alive, they began to split up into competing groups. You know, we shouldn't think of, I often think of this and the devils of hell, in that, you know, they don't love each other. They hate each other in hell. And this is also true in so many of these other movements, and that they only cooperate insofar as they can help promote themselves. But they don't love each other. And in this movement, they were, even before she was dead cold in the ground, they began to fight among themselves and start rival groups. And the rival groups continue to this day. So that helped to keep the Theosophical Society small. But also, and I think the most important reason that the Theosophical Society remains small, is that like Madame Blavatsky, it is very, very elitist. You might contact these peasants. We know the ascended masters of the Great White Brotherhood, and we contact them. That's part of their appeal, this very elitist group. And they keep talking about esoteric knowledge. They love esoteric knowledge. They're very, very fond of that. And at the more esoteric, and they know what really went on in history. You people have a very superficial, exoteric understanding of history. We know the real story. And if you join us, you'll know the real story too. Well, this again appeals to very few people. But it appeals to a lot of very wealthy people. And the Theosophical Society has a bunch of bucks. They are very wealthy. And they've been left many bequests by wealthy people. So there's plenty of money in their coffers. But they remain small and yet influential. One of the things they did that has had reverberations recently is that in 1892, there's supposed to be a World Fair in Chicago to show off how the city rebuilt itself after our disastrous fire in 1871. And they couldn't quite get it together for 1892, so they had it in 1893. Madame Blavatsky and the Lucifer Trust, because that's what she called her publishing house, the Lucifer Trust. Remember that Lucifer or Satan is not evil, because there is no evil in the world. Remember that if you believe that everything is one and everything is God, there's no such thing as evil in this New Age mentality. Lucifer is the light bearer. And so it's okay to name something after him. You Christians have taken Lucifer, made him into a demon. I don't think we made him into a demon, but be that as it may, that's the way they see it. We've demonized Satan, ironically enough. And that they tried to rescue him. Now, people so objected to the name Lucifer Trust that now its name was later changed to the Lucis or Lucius Trust, the Trust of Light. But it comes from Lucifer. That's where they get from. And they still, I don't know if they still publish, but I think they still do. I think they're still in business. Well, what she did is, with the Lucifer Trust, as backing this, had the first world parliament, the first parliament of world religions. And brought in a Hindu Swami to speak. It was Vivekananda, I think. Swami Vivekananda. And he was he caused a major sensation that somebody from India would come over here and he would speak so simply and so beautifully, and people loved to hear the Swami Vivekananda. And especially those who had already made a move to Unitarianism and Universalism, to the ideas of Thoreau and Emerson, who had themselves translated the Upanishads and other Hindu writings. And this appealed to especially a lot of Protestant ministers of the liberal persuasion. Liberal Protestantism was on the rise in the late 1800s, by the 1890s. And so this had a strong appeal to how open-minded we are and how prophetic. We are not closed-minded to these people. We have an openness to them. This Parliament of World Religions in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair had a major impact on the religious life of this country and the openness that people had to Spiritism and to Hindu religion and Buddhism. And again, set among the leaders on the religious level a certain openness to Oriental religions, which will come to play as we go on in the New Age movement. Also, you had, at the same time, a number of scientists who began to investigate Spiritism. And Nobel Prize winners became converted to it, saying it has to be true. I mean, we've investigated. These people can't be faking it. We've looked at it scientifically. Now, as a matter of fact, there was one Nobel Prize winner who became totally converted to it and kept on spending the rest of his life trying to prove how true this was. What was found out only later is that the spiritist that he was investigating had become his lover. So he was discussing this over pillow talk as well as, in scientific experiments. So this is not exactly objective. A few other feelings got in the way of objective investigation. But it convinced a lot of other people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes. And did he do Tarzan too? Didn't he do Tarzan? Or somebody else? But he certainly did Sherlock Holmes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had been a Catholic. His son died. He became furious with God over the death of his son. So he left the church and became a spiritist. And he's written some important, one of the early histories of spiritism and became a big proponent of it. It's interesting that the scientists were fairly easy to dupe by the spiritists. They could trick the spiritists pretty easily. The ones that they could not trick were the magicians. Harry Houdini was one of the best experts at exposing the frauds of these spiritists. These people were having ectoplasm. Any of you see Ghostbusters? Remember Ghostbusters? Again, rent that. Get the video. You get an idea of some, they're making fun of a lot of what's happening, but there's a, you also get an idea of some of the key concepts being humorously treated, as did the Three Stooges and Abbott and Costello, a lot of the great comedians, of the past, century, made fun of spiritism. But also you get an idea of what was being believed by through the mockery. And ectoplasm is this, slime that comes out of the spirits. And these people in the spiritism were producing ectoplasm of all kinds. Tables would rise and, there'd be trumpets going around the build, the room. And, people would hold hands and the table would float up. And scary kids, I'm telling you, this is really scary when the table falls. But it was all trickery. And Harry Houdini could safely offer $10,000 as a prize to anybody who really could prove to him they communicated with the dead. And he would expose all of their frauds. He never had to pay the $10,000. So this is, truly amazing. And right after World War I, spiritism took another major soaring up. Because for the same reason as after the Civil War, people wanted to contact their dead dads, husbands, and brothers. And so a man who had studied for the ministry in the Disciples of Christ Church was a fellow named Arthur Ford. He became such a popular spiritist that he was called the Pope of Spiritism. He was the number one spiritist in this country. And he would go abroad and even do spiritism in Germany and other countries. And he would just give all this information. He had a spirit who was French-Canadian. He said it was a kid that he had known when he was a boy in Florida. Though the story changed a number of times in his life. But he said this kid had died and now it was his familiar spirit. And he would contact the spirit of this kid. Fletcher was his name. And Fletcher would go and talk to the spirits of other people. And Fletcher would speak to Arthur Ford, with a slight French-Canadian accent. Well, but the other people never would speak to Ford. Ford's familiar spirit, Fletcher, would contact the other spirits for you. And he would relay the information from, most people wanted to know, are you in happiness or are you in torment? Did you go to heaven or hell? That was the information. Well, they all went to heaven. Yeah, they all went to heaven. So that was all good news, and they were all willing to pay. Oh, my husband's in heaven. Oh, thank God. So this was, a big part of the spiel. And Ford remained very popular until he had a car accident. The pain was very great, and during his recuperation in the 30s, he became an alcoholic. And he died of his alcoholism in 1971. But just keep that name in mind, because he has a very big influence on what goes on in the New Age movement today. Another character from the same period is the sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce. Have you heard of Edgar Cayce? There probably are 50 books by Edgar Cayce, posthumously published. And what they were, all these books by Edgar Cayce are not books that he wrote as books, but they are selections from his writings, which were all numbered. What did Edgar Cayce do? He also had a sickness, and he used self-hypnosis to cure himself, he claims. And after work for himself, he began to go into a hypnotic trance, self-induced hypnotic trance, and cure other people. That's why it's called the sleeping prophet. He was hypnotized. He would take off his shoes, loosen his belt, loosen his neck collar, become relaxed, go into a hypnotic trance, and then you would tell him about somebody or give a letter about somebody or something that the person owned as time went on. And a spirit that Edgar Cayce called the entity would tell him what to do to cure that person. And his cures were typically very unorthodox. Take honey, apple cider vinegar, and a poultice of figs or whatever. And they have all these little cures to balance off the acid or the alkaline in your system. That was a big part of his whole approach, balancing off the acids and the alkalines in your system. Now, as he began doing these cures, his entity began giving other information. The entity would tell more about that person's life than just their illness, and sometimes would give information about their past lives. And then Edgar Cayce found out about his own past lives. And then people started to focus more about their past lives than about their present cures. And then he started to do the past lives of Jesus. Jesus was reincarnated 95 times, according to Cayce, before Jesus earned the right to become the Christ. Now, what's amazing about this belief by Edgar Cayce is that Cayce was a Sunday school Bible teacher in his denomination. He also had been Disciples of Christ, became a Presbyterian, or at least went to the Presbyterian Church, and taught Bible. He knew that reincarnation contradicted the Bible. But he continued to teach it because the entity told him it was true. And he began to believe the entity rather than the scriptures. And he taught this stuff and wrote it down. All the information got written down. And this is a huge amount of information. At the Association for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach, Virginia. That's where the headquarters are, ARE. And this, they have all of these messages cataloged by number, and they draw out of them different books. So Edgar Cayce's teachings on Jesus, where he describes Jesus' incarnations. You know, Jesus was Adam, and then he was Enoch, and then he was, I don't know if he was Noah or not, but then he was Joshua, and Moses. You know, part of the problem with this is that some of these people were living at the same time. He was reincarnated as two people at once. He kept coming back. He eventually was Zoroaster. And as a matter of fact, when Jesus was reincarnated as Zoroaster, Edgar Cayce was his daddy. So, you know, he knew Jesus back then. And this idea of Jesus being reincarnated again and again and again shows up in a New Age book called Mary's Message to the World, Annie Kirkland. Are you familiar with that book? Some of you have seen it. Yes, some of you are nodding yes. Where she says how Jesus and Mary have been reincarnated many, many times. And Joseph and Mary were reincarnated together many times. So they've earned the right to become the parents of Jesus. And this idea of reincarnation as a way of earning the right to spiritual enlightenment and to being Christ becomes a major belief in the New Age movement, from people like Edgar Cayce and others related to his work. Now, you know, as you know, world history took some real topsy turns in the 1930s and 40s with World War II, the Japanese invasion of China, and then the rise of Nazism, the consolidation of Germany and Austria, the invasion of Poland and the beginning of World War II, all of that, and then the aftermath of the war, which we're still seeing the finish of, aren't we? I mean, so many of the wars that we've seen in the last years were proxies for the superpowers after the war and continued World War II. So now it's just about finally coming to an end. But, you know, all of those events distracted people until the 1950s, and in the mid-50s, Spiritism comes right back. I don't know if you're aware of it. There's a town in Florida where the whole town are Spiritists. It's owned by a Spiritist church. Every building in town is owned by the Spiritist church. Now, there's sort of a Hatfields and McCoy situation developing over there between the old-time Spiritists and the new-time New Agers. The New Agers are on one side of the road, and the Spiritists are on the other. They don't get along too well. But this town in Florida, northern Florida, north of Orlando, about 2 hours, hour and a half, you know, is all Spiritists. And their Spiritist camps and meetings and seminars grew like wildfire throughout the 1950s and into the 60s. And where this becomes important is that a woman who was a very, very famous and extremely competent reporter, Ruth Montgomery, began to be investigating as a reporter Spiritism. Her sister married a Spiritist. And Ruth and her husband went to a Spiritist church just to see what they were doing. And Ruth Montgomery began to, you know, experiment with reporting on these Spiritist meetings. And she would have fun with it. She would go there and people would meet her and say hello. And she would give specifically false information about her life to strangers. And then she'd go have seances done. And the people doing the seance would give her that same false information she'd given because they were shills throughout the crowd, you know, that, you know, worked for the Spiritists. And that's the way most of that works, is the shills. But sometimes she would become impressed and fascinated. She even did she was the ghostwriter for the famous Catholic Spiritist Jean Dixon. You know who Jean Dixon is, right? She claims to be a good Catholic, daily communicant. At least she used to be. I don't know if she still is. And every New Year's, people ask Jean Dixon's predictions because she allegedly was able to predict the assassination of John Kennedy. So she became very popular because of that. And Ruth Montgomery was the ghostwriter for her, as well as for one of the first books by a former nun, I Left Over the Wall. Remember that? She was the ghostwriter for that. Some of us who remember in the 60s, what a shock it was. A nun left the convent and, you know, wrote a book about it. Oh, wow. Well, she was ghostwriter for that, as well as being a very, very rebel. She knew every president from Roosevelt through Johnson and had interviewed them all. You know, she was so well respected. But she got wackier and wackier with the Spiritism because she met Arthur Ford. Remember the guy I talked about who was the Pope of Spiritism? She met up with him to interview him, and he taught her how to hypnotize herself and go into a hypnotic trance. And she began to do automatic writing for spirits called Lily and a whole group of other spirits. She also moved to Virginia Beach, Virginia. And she did research at the Edgar Cayce AR Institute, ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment. So she began to investigate that. And it's amazing how only after she started researching Edgar Cayce did her spirits begin saying things that agreed with Edgar Cayce. Prior to living in Virginia Beach, her spirits never said anything along the lines of Edgar Cayce's revelations. After reading Edgar Cayce's material, all of a sudden her spirits start to give the same predictions about a shift in the axis of the earth. because Edgar Cayce said that in 1968, the continent of Atlantis would rise out of the Atlantic Ocean. Did I miss that? And that a great crystal that ran all of the power and powered every vehicle on the continent of Atlantis would come out of the ocean. And we would be able to give energy for every single vehicle on the planet based on that crystal. Okay? Now, that sounds so far-fetched, doesn't it? A, such a crystal has not arisen out of the ocean. B, and this is one of the things that, you know, I was talking about this in class once, just as joking around about it. And a student says, you mean there isn't such a crystal? And I said, no, why did you think there was? I said, well, Sister so-and-so, a Franciscan, and the sister at the campus ministry at Loyola University, had told him about this crystal, and he was going to go into gemology so that he could help to discover it and stop the energy crisis. This was going to be this boy's career because of the influence of a nun to go find this. That's why, you know, on one hand, it sounds so absurd. But when a Catholic sister is teaching students through campus ministry to devote their life to finding a mythological, enormous crystal to power all of the vehicles on the planet Earth, we know that we have more than just a casual problem. And the Ruth Montgomery began to say the same predictions. She began saying, exactly as Edgar Cayce says, that the reason that we had a fall into original sin is because certain spirits started getting into bodies. And they would jump in and out of bodies. And they like bodies so much because it's so much fun getting in a body, especially with sexuality, that some of them forgot to become, to stay spiritual, and they got stuck in the bodies. And they also got mixed up. So, because they would start to copulate with one another. And there were all sorts of mixtures so that there were centaurs and minotaurs, half fool, half man, half horse, half man. And Ruth Montgomery, like Edgar Cayce said, these were real. These aren't myths. They really existed. Satyrs, who are half man, half goat, really existed because these spirits copulated with one another, half animal, half man. And that's how those things existed. And then there was a flood, and that ended it. But they used to really exist, and we'll find the bones. We will, really. For sure. You know, that's the way they talk. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. But true. Well, the reason I mentioned something about Arthur Ford and this lady is because another character comes into play for the development of this New Age movement. Namely, Bishop James Pike. Do you remember him? He was the Episcopalian Bishop of Los Angeles. Like the present Episcopal Bishop of Newark and other places, he was a stone liberal, completely liberalized theologically. He didn't believe in the resurrection, the virgin birth, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all that was out. But when his son died in a car wreck, this man who was skeptical about the Christian doctrines he had sworn an oath to defend went to Arthur Ford, and they held the first televised seance in history on Canadian television. And Arthur Ford contacted his spirit, Fletcher, and Fletcher contacted the son of Bishop James Pike on the air. And he was giving so many details about James Pike's son. And he just gave detail after detail, just absolutely phenomenal. James Pike publicly admitted, this has to be true. The resurrection of Jesus? No, I don't believe that. Arthur Ford, I believe. Now, this is an example of what G.K. Chesterton said when he describes somebody who had lost their faith. The people who lose their faith do not believe in nothing. They will believe in anything. Remember that as a principle. When someone loses their faith, they don't believe in nothing. They'll believe in anything. And James Pike is a classic example. So much so that it led to his death, tragically, because the spirits continued to speak to him and told him that he would go and speak to his son directly if he went to the Judean desert. He went off to the Judean desert and died there of dehydration. Now, this is something, there's something else about that death that seems to be funny business. Because I go to the Holy Land a lot. I go there 3 or 4 times a year. I've got my license as a guide over there, and I take groups over. And I have a lot of friends who are guides, especially Palestinian Christian guides I know pretty well. And I've asked them about this story of James Pike. This Bishop James Pike went off and died in the desert. They just freeze. They go, don't talk about this, Father. This is not good. This is not good to talk about. And I said, but what happened? What happened? So, Father, don't talk about these things. So, all right. But they get very frightened. So there's something that frightened them too about it. But he went off to these spirits, listened to them, and died in the desert. You know, at least according to officially of dehydration. So this was, quite a terrible thing. To add to the tragedy, 3 years later, in 1971, January, Arthur Ford died. His executor was an Episcopalian priest, and his executor found a manila file on James Pike's son. He didn't get that information from spirits. He had kept a file on James Pike's kid, and that's where he got all that information from newspaper reports about his death, James Pike's death, James Pike Jr.'s death. And that's how he knew all this stuff. And James Pike, Bishop James Pike, was drawn into believing in spiritism and dying because of following it, because of this guy's deception. It's tragic. Tragic. Now, just to give a couple other points of how this developed into the New Age movement. In the 1960s, a lot of you can remember what times were like. You know, it was a crazy time. And we saw a major transition in our culture from 1965 on. And it's not been a change for the better overall. 1965 was the year that sociologists point to as making the major increase in divorce. So that, and from that time until the present, divorce has steadily climbed at frightening rates. Single motherhood has climbed and at frightening rates. And there's an ideology, of course, in the late 60s, early 70s, that this is just an alternate form of family. Why should we have a mom and dad together? Well, somehow that, you know, the way the babies get there is a mom and dad being together. And it seems to be a good idea to keep them that way. You know, that's, it works, as a matter of fact, there's a great article from, I think it's 3 or 4 years ago, I think it's right after the, Clinton took over, took office, there was an article in the Atlantic Monthly, April, saying, called Dan Quayle Was Right. And they wouldn't talk, they had it ready before that, the summer before, but they didn't want it to be part of the election, because Lord knows, Atlantic Monthly doesn't think that Dan Quayle was right on politics. But what they were talking about is Dan Quayle was right about family values. And that the breakdown of the family was absolutely right on. And they had gave study after study after study. If you can check into that article, it's well worth Xeroxing at the library and knowing that article just about the decline in of family. We also saw the war and the race problems in the 60s, the war in Vietnam and the race problems. And as someone who, you know, was a, I was freshman in high school when John Kennedy was shot, and a freshman in college during the when the National Guard fired on the students at Kent State. And we just saw, you know, war protests increasing, race riots in our cities, and just a terrible time. And this is a time in which it became quite acceptable to become a flower child and a hippie, right? Some of us can remember those days. Some of us even grew hair below our shoulders and wore beads and all that stuff. And this was a time of rejecting Western values. You know, it is the oppression of the West that leads to the, subjugation of the black man in this country, of the, the Asian, and we're sending the black man to kill the Asian, and it's all white Europeans doing this stuff, and, we gotta break free of this white European imposed culture and religion. And we need to learn the religions of other peoples, and, also, we've got to break out of the family, and free love became very popular, and living in communes, just living off the land, and hitchhiking across the country, and reading Buddhism, doing drugs, all of this became part of the culture for his college kids. At least the college kids who made the news. I'm not sure it was necessarily a majority. I don't even think it was a majority of college kids. But the kids who made the news, and who then set the tone for what became a majority in the 70s. In the 70s, more than half of kids tried drugs. And now it's to the point where, most high school grads are no longer virgins when they leave high school. And that they start sexual experimenting in grammar school at age 12 and 13. 12 is not unusual, 11 even. Those changes from that time are having major effects on us to this day. And it's in this atmosphere that a lot of things start to converge. A rejection of Christianity, a rejection of Western culture, a rejection of Western science and logic, and fascination with Hinduism and Buddhism, a fascination with drugs. And it's, again, it fit right into the times that you had a number of professors who were experimenting with Hinduism and Buddhism and with LSD. Ram Dass, for instance, from Harvard, and Timothy Leary, his associate. You also had a former Episcopal priest, Alan Watts, experimenting with the Oriental religion and with drugs. He also died of alcoholism. He became very popular. J.T. Suzuki became very popular as a Hindu and Buddhist writer. All of this began to percolate in the culture. And astrology, and this is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, became a popular song. And this is the kind of convergence that was happening in the 60s that played one off of the other. And Ruth Montgomery began to publish what her spirits were telling her. And it sold like hotcakes. And that inspired other people to contact spirits and write down what the spirits told them. Jane Roberts became the next successful publisher of her spirit, Seth, that she started to contact with the Ouija board. And she would write down what Seth said, and Seth just stopped with the Ouija board. It took too long to write with the Ouija board. He jumped inside her body and started to speak through her. And this then led to all kinds of other spiritists starting up. And after, a good, 7-8 years of spiritism starting to become popular as a publishing device, and drug use, the use of hypnosis, various new therapies like S, Erhard Seminar Training, Silva Mind Control, both of which started in the late 60s, early 70s. The influence of Scientology, which started in the 50s, became more popular in the 60s. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who came from India, along with other gurus, and just, and in this, the late 60s, early 70s, just took off, you know, among students and hippies of different types. And they were able to make a living through publishing spiritist books, through teaching transcendental meditation, and opening up head shops with drug paraphernalia. And all, a lot of this stuff figured in together. And people were doing the spirituality of drugs and Hinduism together. And this stuff was just, the books, The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, these type of books, you know, sort of fed these ideas one on top of another. The mysticism of LSD and of marijuana, that all fit together, along with Hinduism. And it just became a mishmash. So much so that by 1975, all of this gets to be called the New Age Movement. That's when they start to call it the New Age Movement. And people begin by 1980 to make a living off of this stuff. These are hippies who grew up and they needed to live. They didn't want to give up their new consciousness and their new culture, but they had to make a living. And they found a way to do that with the 2,500 New Age bookstores that exist across this country, the New Age there are 50 New Age publishing houses across this country, and the workshops and seminars that have brought in billions of dollars annually. And it's all of this fitting together, along with the disillusionment with the Western culture, that have given us what we now call the New Age movement. And we're still dealing with the effects of it. Now, what I'd like to do is to take a break at this point and start to talk about how some of this has influenced the Catholic Church. This is how it influences the general culture. But we Catholics are also Americans, and we are affected by our society. And inside the Catholic Church, we have effects. And that's what I'd like to talk about this afternoon in the next talk this morning. Okay? Thank you. Thank you.